Blog Talk Radio.
Spend some time in the country, we're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country, leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone, the best in music too. Spend some time in the country, we've been waiting here for you. Here in the country, waiting here for you.
You found the place for up close and personal interviews with your favorite country stars. This is In the Country, hosted by Dave Wood. Stay tuned for great stories and great music. Now live from Ontario and heard around the world, welcome to the show.
On the show today, I'll be talking with Dr. Kent Gustafson, who has written a book entitled Blind But Now I See, the biography of music legend Doc Watson. Get ready for some fascinating stories about this country, folk, and bluegrass singer and musician. There's lots to learn about Doc Watson. My guest, Dr. Kent Gustafson, earned his PhD from Stony Brook University in New York, where he now teaches music, leadership, and language. My pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Kent Gustafson. Hey, Kent, how's it going this evening?
It's going great. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing very well. It's great to have you on the show. Of course, we're going to be covering all about Doc Watson and the book you've written about him. But let's start off by getting some background on you. I know that you not only teach, but you've put out some recordings yourself.
Yeah, I've dabbled in a thing or two over the last several years, and I put a couple albums together at different times. My favorite is a trio I had with two guys from graduate school, actually Baroque musicians who are also jazz musicians, and we did a trio record together that combined old-time music and Baroque music. That was a fun one.
Wow, yeah, I had a chance to go on, I think it was Amazon, and check out some of your songs and your vocals specifically. It's really good stuff. Really, the particular stuff I was listening to is really peaceful. That may be the trio, I'm not sure.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's called Stolen Shack is the one album, and I have a whole bunch of other this and that out there.
Now, you teach, I think you teach music from time to time along with leadership and language. When you do teach the music classes, what is it that you like to invoke and share with your students?
Well, I've done a whole bunch of teaching sort of mainstream music students about traditional American music, and it's surprising how much they know and how little they know at the same time. You know, you always have to use sort of conduits like Bob Dylan and names that they still know of like Ben Harper in order to get them into the old time music. But once they hear it, they're in love, a lot of them, with it. So
I'll bet, because in a lot of cases it would be the first time hearing some of the people you're speaking of, and that's interesting with the conduits. So you're taking somebody who's somewhat current and showing how it traces back to some of these older artists.
Exactly, and actually with the book, it's with my book on Doc, I've gotten a little bit of criticism from people who say, you know, why include people like Ben Harper and Abigail Washburn and folks who didn't necessarily know Doc really well, but are very, very popular in the public eye. And my reasoning for that is that it's important to see and trace the lineage back from somebody like Ben Harper, who sold millions of albums, to somebody like Doc Watson and the great influence
yep.
Doc's music plays in pop and contemporary music.
Yeah, a lot of times the modern artists do have inspiration that came from these older artists, and so it keeps getting passed on, and you know, all that good stuff keeps going. What brought you to the point, what inspired you to write this book about Doc Watson?
Well, I was actually going to continue on the point before, and that relates to this really well, which is
sure.
I grew up on Pete Seeger. My parents just told me a couple of weeks ago that I heard Pete Seeger in the womb, live, you know, as he came to every little holler in the whole country, you know, over that several decades, you know, just from small town to small town. And I saw him several times growing up, you know, and we'd sit around as a family and sing and play folk music. And but the thing about back to that last question too is I went to the 90th birthday party of Pete Seeger and. At Madison Square Garden. That was a neat event, and I remember seeing Dave Matthews there, who's you know, a mega star among today's young people, And he said his first concert was a Pete Seeger concert, and that you know, stuck with me, because I thought about that, and I said, yeah, mine too. I think a whole generation started out on Pete Seeger and Doc too, and I think if it weren't for Pete Seeger, we wouldn't know of Doc. So there's a really common origin back there in the 60s in the folk music scene.
And as we talk about Doc, I'll encourage right now our listeners, we're going to share a couple of songs on the show, but to go to iTunes and YouTube and different places to discover the music of Doc Watson if they haven't listened to him previously. And they're going to be in for some very pleasant surprises and great music. Let's trace back to the beginnings of Doc, and maybe we'll start with his real name and sort of the year he was born and the area and all that. Kent?
Sure, yeah. Well, his real given name was Arthel Lane Watson, and in the book, I like to a lot of biographers like to go back to names, and I think they say a lot. His real name, actually on his birth certificate, was written Arthel with an O umlaut, so he was actually sort of falsely christened on his birth certificate, because his name's actually spelled Arthel, which is an old Irish name, A-R-T-H-E-L. And then Lane, of course, well, we think, oh, well, we've heard that name before, but it's a beautiful name because it means a roadway. And when you think of, you know, the road that Doc's traveled, that's a beautiful name. But he first got his name Doc only, you know, 2 decades after he was born. He was born in 23 to a family in a holler right off the road to Boone, and the trail that Daniel Boone also took, the Wilderness Road, right off that trail. It was called Deep Gap, and in Watoga County, and
wow.
He was born at home to his grandmother as the midwife.
Interesting. So some very humble beginnings, and like a lot of these singers, they've lived the songs they end up singing about. It comes from true experience.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about, I was just watching yesterday, I was just for the first time watching the Bela Fleck movie, was it called Throw Down My Heart? Beautiful movie where Bela Fleck goes to Africa, and you can see how emotional he is when he sees really real folk music, visceral folk music. Walks around and sees how people live the music and sing while they're working, and I think Doc lived in a time like that before radio. You know, it was a time before records where if he heard music, it wasn't very often, and it was really special. It was when his granny was shelling peas on the front porch, and it was when he was in his mother's arms in church.
And before he turned one, he lost his sight. So we not only have a very talented singer and musician, but somebody who had something to overcome that, you know, some people that may have stood in their way, but it didn't stand in his way.
Yeah, and it's a really sad story. Anytime you hear the tale of someone who's either gone blind in their youth or been born blind, and the interesting thing about Doc is it's not that sad a story. There's a couple things about his blindness. One is that he wouldn't be as well educated if he weren't blind. It seems kind of strange, but if he hadn't gone to the blind school that the state of North Carolina mandated in Raleigh, he wouldn't have had his, you know, 8 years of education. You know, his brothers and sisters didn't get that excellent education. They didn't learn how to play piano and about harmony and all of that, but Doc did. He had those opportunities. And he also, very famously, would go and play around with especially his younger brother David, and they'd run all over the place and cause trouble and spend the whole day outside climbing trees. And you know, there's stories that Doc tells about sitting up in the crook of a tree and feeling the wind, and there's stories about him running with his dog, and then there's stories about his brothers throwing rocks over his head so Doc could hear him whiz by and accidentally hitting him in the head. I mean, there's wonderful stories about his childhood, but he ran around like anybody in that era did.
And I understand he's a great storyteller, so when he's performing, and still to this day, it must be quite something, not only the songs, but the stories that go with them.
Yeah, and I think in his older years now, he's getting up there. He's 87 years old, 88 coming up this year. I think he's sort of said, well, you know, I've told all the stories before. Let's just kind of get a show down. And David Holt gave him that opportunity. So he does these shows now. If you've not heard Doc before, it's a wonderful show to go to because Doc tells these stories about his childhood and David sort of asks him the questions. If you've already seen it, yeah, Doc doesn't vary it up too much, but it's a wonderful thing to go out and see him still out on the road all these years later. But especially the stuff I like the best is as a biographer, I've heard so many interviews with him and, you know, just hundreds and hundreds that when I hear something unique pop out, that's when it's really moving. You know, probably the most tear-jerking story Doc tells is right after his son died, one of the next couple nights he had a terrible dream where he was sinking in quicksand and he couldn't get out. And this big hand reached down and pulled him out of that quicksand and said, "You can keep going." And that was, you know, it was Merle's hand. It was Merle leading him out. But of course, you know, our dreams aren't just our dreams. So, I mean, his deep religious sense, and you can kind of combine all that in your head. But he's told that story a few times. Once to Studs Terkel for a wonderful chapter in Studs' book, and then once to I can't remember which, I think Terry Gross on NPR. But there's certain stories that Doc doesn't tell very often that just are just so stunning. And actually, among the people I interviewed for this book, Peter Rowan, for example, he says, "Oh, yeah, Doc and I would sit around and talk about the spirituality of Native Americans." And someone else will say, "Oh, yeah, Doc and I would sit around and talk about this and that." Ricky Skaggs said, "Oh, Doc and I, we feast on the honey. Or we feast on honeycomb," and he was talking about their shared religion together. And Doc just knows how to regale people. You know, he knows how to tell a story and make people feel comfortable.
Now, you did quite a few interviews, and you alluded to a few of them there. Do you want to talk about the number of interviews and just who you spoke with that is a part of the book? Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Kent Gustafson, and the book is Blind, But Now I See. It's the biography of music legend Doc Watson.
Well, I spoke with all sorts of heroes of mine, which is pretty humbling. I mean, you know, there are times where I'd be kind of quaking in my boots before chatting with people, and it's fun. It is a blast. But after about 30 seconds a minute, these incredible figures immediately would be thinking about their mentor and friend and idol, Doc Watson. And some of my favorite interviews, there's also all sorts of interviews. There's an interview with Tony Rice where, gosh, what an honor to speak with Tony Rice. You know, interview with Ricky Skaggs, and an interview with Alan O'Brien, the incredible singer from the Nashville Bluegrass Band. A lot of just incredible opportunities to talk with people about their relationship with Doc. Tom Paxton, who talked about knowing Doc in the mid-60s. And then there were some unexpected ones. You know, Maria Muldaur, who's an incredible singer still. She has a great album she just put out that's just stunning. But she was just a girl in Greenwich Village in New York and hung out with Doc as she was in her late teens and watched all of this and met Clarence Ashley and Doc Watson when she was just a kid. And then went down to visit Doc when his house was still primitive. You know, it was still, he wasn't a big star yet. And she had some incredible insights because she looks at Doc the way we do, a lot of us. I didn't grow up in the place Doc did. And so Maria really sort of, she said he had a, you know, she was so fascinated that he had a washing, the fan from a washing machine Doc was using as a ventilator for his house, and he'd hand-built his outhouse, and this blind man had done all these incredible gadgets and work around the farm, and, you know, how incredible is that?
Oh, totally, totally. Now, he became famous later in life. He wasn't one of these artists who got discovered early on. Was it around his 40th, somewhere in there, that he started to get recognition for what he does?
Yeah, and I think there's a different point for recognition by different folks, and his first you know, in terms of money, his first real paychecks came in when he was signed with Vanguard, and that was in the mid-60s. But he was discovered, in quotes, in 1960 when Ralph Rinsler came down. Now, when Doc first came to New York, he pretty much played to a small folk audience in an elementary school auditorium. So it was, you know, not small, but it was Doc and it was Clarence Ashley and it was a, you know, an old-time band. And Doc was one of the musicians, and he sang Amazing Grace and absolutely floored everyone there. And a lot of the people there were, you know, from Maria Muldaur to John Cohen to all these people who later influenced the whole folk music movement. Maria Muldaur recalls that actually Woody Guthrie was there. I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but if it is, it's a wonderful thing to think about, that maybe Woody, who was suffering at that point, was brought by Spider, what's his name, Ramblin' Jack Elliott to the concert. But, you know, Doc didn't really get famous outside of the folk music crowd until the mid-60s when his first Vanguard record came out called Doc Watson. And then, you know, towards the end of the 60s, it was really Merle that pulled Doc into the sort of started to pull him into the mainstream. And in the early 70s, of course, with the Will the Circle Be Unbroken album, Doc really hit the mainstream. People knew who he was. He could have gone into the pop charts. They could have gone that direction. But they were really the foundation of Newgrass music, what we now call Newgrass, with
right.
Sam Bush and Tony Rice and all those guys.
Yeah.
Doc and Merle were really at that foundation.
We're going to come back and talk about lots more. We're going to pick up there, and we're going to go back a bit in time as well to the influence that his parents had on him as far as musically. But we're going to share a song now called Blue Railroad Train. And any thoughts on this one? Of course, a train song, and he loved those, didn't he, Kent?
He did. I mean, I think any kid growing up in the 20s and 30s, I mean, the train was the big engine and the whistles and the... And it's actually a lot of the old-timers, they know how to do those train whistles, and Doc loves the railroad songs. And in this song especially, it's such a smooth sound. He's got the Travis picking in his guitar playing and his crooning voice. And we can hear the sounds of the hills, but we can also hear the sound of Nashville in here.
This is Doc Watson and Blue Railroad Train here out in the country.
Down the railroad track, it makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. To hear the whistle blow, she's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be a guest. old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Music legend Doc Watson and Blue Railroad Train here on In the Country. I'm speaking with Dr. Kent Gustafson, who has written Blind But Now I See, the biography of music legend Doc Watson. Before we go any further, Kent, where can our listeners order your book from?
Well, they can order it just about anywhere. If they can't order it just about anywhere, they should talk to their local independent store and have them order it. But Amazon or Barnes & Noble or just about anywhere. Actually, I should probably give a plug to Flat Picking Guitar Magazine because they've sold a whole bunch of copies. Dan Miller over there brings them out to bluegrass shows and has them for sale on his site too. So,
awesome, that's great. Yeah, there are some good Doc Watson sites out there that our listeners can head to the internet and look for. What was the role and the influence that Doc's parents played on his musical path?
Well, I think Doc's parents are an interesting phenomenon. They were both highly intelligent, though not very book educated. You know, Doc's dad worked really hard. He worked for the, during the Civilian Conservation Corps, he worked on the university there in Boone, building the structures there. He worked on the highway, Blue Ridge Parkway, all sorts of things to make a living. And they also would log timber and all sorts of different things to make ends meet. But his dad was a really wise man, a very learned man when it came to the Bible, and especially when it came to music. His dad led the choir, the equivalent to the choir. There was a small group of folks who would always be there to lead the singing in the church, and Doc described his dad as always trudging down there with the kids, and rain or snow or anything, they'd be there, and they walked there, you know. And that was a big thing, and most nights they would sit together and have a devotional with their father, and he would give a verse from the Bible, and sometimes they'd sing a song. And he was a very strict man, but also a very kind man, and I think that really comes through Doc's playing. And I personally believe that, and I think Doc does too, that his father knew that there was that his son would do something great someday. Doc always tells the story of the crosscut saw. He got basically kicked out of the Raleigh School for the Blind for roughhousing and smoking and things that Doc doesn't really like to talk about nowadays. But they also weren't all that kind to him, and it wasn't the best place to be. But Doc wasn't necessarily a model student. But he didn't want to go back. And at age 13, he decided not to go back. And he moped around for a long time. And one day, Doc's dad made a decision. And he brought Doc out on a crosscut saw, and they sawed. He taught him how to cut lumber. He taught him how to do what they thought of as a man's work. And Doc came home exhausted, but he learned how to be just like everybody else, and that he could make a living. He didn't just have to, be out on the streets begging like they taught him to do at the blind school.
Right, yeah, that's a great independence for him, and obviously gives him confidence to tackle the other things he would end up tackling in life.
Right. Well, and when it comes down to his dad's music influence musically, his dad taught him the harmonica. You know, his dad taught him how to frail a couple tunes on the banjo. His dad built him a junky banjo with a groundhog head, and then his dad figured out that a cat skin head would be good, and so he stretched a cat hide over the banjo, and Doc loved that thing. His dad built it for him, if Doc had been able, he'd have been out there working every day. He wouldn't have been the musician he is today. And his dad encouraged him to be a great person and a good human being. And now, in terms of Doc's mother, she was a a wonderful woman also in Doc's memories, and she used to sing to all the kids and lullabies, and she'd hum and sing around the house like most women in that area did in the Appalachians in that time. And in her family, she had some singing teachers, so singing had been a part of their religious life for a long time and home life. And so I think he was just around the music a whole bunch, and both of the parents encouraged him.
And the first song he ended up playing on the guitar, probably very popular back in those times, of course, the Carter Family's When the Roses Bloom in Dixieland. That was the very first one. I guess his dad was quite proud of him.
Yeah. It's a funny story. Doc let slip in one interview that I think he tricked his dad. I think he sort of knew the chords to that song already. but he perfected it. There's the story he tells is that he borrowed a guitar. His dad. What really happened is his brother and his brother had borrowed a guitar, and Doc was strumming around on it and just, you know, making it sound kind of horrible and just playing around. And his dad said to him, he said, "Well, if you can do something on that thing by the time I get home, we'll go out and buy you one." So you can imagine the pride in a kid thinking, "Oh man, I want to make my dad proud." And I guess he doesn't know that I already know most of a song. And so Doc sat around the whole day and figured out how to play and sing at the same time. And his dad was so impressed. His dad and brother and he went down to the store, and the money that Doc had saved up, I believe it was about half of it. And I think Doc's dad and brother chipped in the other half, and they bought him this guitar.
Let's talk about the flat picking style that he became famous for, and he may have invented, and you can talk about that. But he was trying to learn the fiddle, as the story goes, and he wasn't, as far as he says, able to master it. So he liked the sound of the fiddle, and he adapted it to the guitar, which I guess is what the flat picking style is. How does that story go, as far as you know?
Well, there were a bunch of folks who used a flat pick. Innovators, really, you know, from Jimmy Rogers to Skillet Lickers, not Clayton, Riley Puckett of the Skillet Lickers. And there were these, you know, innovators on the guitar who did some incredible runs, you know, the little runs in between the, you know, verses and things like that. And even the Delmore brothers did a lot of amazing guitar work, and so what Doc did is, like any innovator, like Earl Scruggs did also when he was innovating, they just played the way they could. They played however they could, and they tried to imitate their heroes that they heard on the radio,
right.
And they came up with their own styles. And I think Doc didn't necessarily invent flat picking, but he's perfected it to a point to the point that Beethoven perfected the symphony. I mean, his technique, his tone is so even, no one else can match it. There aren't any, in my opinion, there aren't any other players that can match it. The depth and the tone and the precision of Doc Watson's guitar playing. And then in his prime, he was playing with heavy gauge strings, which is, for a guitar player, absolutely crazy. I mean, if you think about those fast runs with heavy gauge strings.
Yep. Hard to keep the press down.
Yeah, and his technique, you know, is a very, very even up and down stroke, and you can just watch his arm and learn a whole bunch. And he's got a lot of great training videos out there, actually, that he's really good at slowing it down for people. And actually, he learned to do that in the 60s when they insisted, because he was such a genius on so many instruments. He could play rock and roll on the guitar. He could play Jimmy Rogers style. He could play any of the blues styles, you know, country blues. He could play the Robert Johnson kind of styles. And he could pick up anything from anybody, and if you listen to I wanted to call them bootlegs. They're not bootlegs. They're tapes that are in the archives of University of North Carolina. You can go to the Folklore Center there, and they've got some of these old tapes where Doc's teaching all these different techniques, and it's just brilliant to listen to.
Now, his son, as you talked about before, Merle, they obviously played music a lot together. He passed away in 1985, and 1988 Merle Fest was created. Can you talk a bit about that? Obviously, a tough time in 85 for Doc.
Yeah, and this is the one controversial topic in this book, and it shouldn't be, because I treated this with a lot of tenderness, I thought. I've also gotten criticism for being too gentle on this topic, but I think it's something a lot of us have thought about, because Doc always talks about his son still 25 years after his death, and so our natural inclination is to want to know what happened, and I think I've been able to uncover pretty well what did happen, and it's more all the more crushing to hear the reality of what happened and the impact that it had on Doc. And Merle late one night while apparently working on some lumber hurt himself, took his tractor that didn't have headlights on it, and if you know North Carolina, it's pitch black at times, and there are very steep roads up in Lenoir where Merle lived. And he went over to a neighbor's house, who, by some accounts, was his former brother-in-law, but a good friend of his. And they sat around, according to some eyewitness accounts, that Merle sat around and had a great night with a friend, and they talked and they reminisced and they drank wine. And Merle, on the way down out of this man's driveway, out of this man's long driveway, the light was on for him, but when he got to near the highway, he missed the corner, or something happened. Nobody will ever know, obviously. And the tractor rolled, and it pinned him underneath. And the neighbors tried as hard as they could to free him, and they couldn't. And it's a tragic, tragic story. I think fairly simple for us to understand the great tragedy this must have been to Doc. Merle was Doc's eyes and ears and his road manager, his playing partner. Doc had been on the road by himself from maybe, 61 he did a couple shows, but from 62 to 64, Doc was by himself. He was with Merle on and off in 65 and 66, but Merle was full-time from 67 to 85. So Doc's entire career, essentially, and half of his life, was spent glued to the side of his son. And you can imagine how awfully jarring that was, not only just personally in his family, but within his career. And it's true, Doc never really went back on tour again after that.
We'll come back in just a moment and talk about Merle Fest, which began in 1988, and you can tell us a bit about that. And then we want to talk about some of the Grammys that Doc has won. But we'll pause for a moment here to share a song he sings a cappella called Down in the Valley to Pray. And I guess he did a few songs like this a cappella. It's so beautiful to hear this. Can you talk about that form of music that he sings?
Oh, I sure can. And actually, you chose a great one, Down in the Valley to Pray. This is the one that Alison Krauss made famous recently again on Brother Where Art Thou soundtrack.
That's about
10 years ago. And she did a beautiful job of it, and it was right in the middle of the film. But Doc sings this just a cappella, and if I'm right, I think this is on his first Vanguard album in 64, and just stunned people that he could be a rip-roaring flat picker, And then have this pensive, wonderful, deep, resonant baritone voice. And it's what sets him apart from the bluegrassers. Doc really was in the folk movement and traditional music, and the voice isn't bluegrass. It's old time, and it's religious, and it's wonderful.
Yep, it's a beautiful song. This is Doc Watson, Down in the Valley to Pray.
As I went down in the valley to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, fathers, let's go down, come on down.
Oh, fathers, let's go down, down in the valley to pray. As I went down in the valley to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, mothers, let's go down, come on down, don't you want to go down? Come on, mothers, and let's go down, down in the valley to pray. As I went down in the valley to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, and let's go down, down in the valley to pray. As I went down in the valley to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Come on, sinners, and let's go down, oh, come on down. Come on, sinners, and let's go down, down in the valley to pray. As I went down in the valley to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way.
Doc Watson and Down in the Valley to Pray. My guest on the show today is Dr. Kent Gustafson. He has written Blind, But Now I See, the biography of music legend Doc Watson. Now, we talked about his son Merle passing away in 85. Then in 88, Merle Fest began. Can you talk about that, Kent?
Yeah, I had a long interview with B. Towns, who's the founder of Merle Fest. And it's an interesting thing how it all started. B. Towns was a horticulturist, an academic like me, and he simply wanted to have a few gardens at the community college where he taught, up right near Doc's house, Wilkes Community College. And in order to do that, he wanted to get some fundraisers going. He was a young professor, and he wanted to really change things there, and he did. He really impacted the campus, and, of course, more than he would know with this festival. And he didn't know Doc. He didn't even know Doc's music. And it was a fascinating interview that I had with him because he talked about how he fell in love with this music by getting to know Doc and being part of this. But Down, so what happened is that they wanted to have a fundraiser, and someone mentioned that Doc lived in the community, and Doc, when he met with B. Towns and a couple other folks, mentioned that obviously Merle had just passed away and that he'd like to do a concert that would be Remember Merle. And that just, to make a long story short, the concept grew because Doc opened up his Rolodex and said, oh, why don't you just get in touch with, let's see, you know, and he laid out all of these different people from Emmylou Harris to Cy Conn to you know, all of his close buddies.
Right.
They all said, sure, of course, we'll come with bells on. And the thing grew, and it became not just one concert inside the building, but also a concert outside, and that's where the idea for the festival started. It just had to grow because there was so much interest around it, and nobody was paid that first year. None of the performers. They all came to pay their respects to Doc, because Doc and Merle really did pave the way for them. A lot of them. Into doing this fusion music that was jazz and it was folk and it was bluegrass and it was everything rolled up into one, and it was embraced even from the beginning of Merle Fest. Americana music, a family surrounding good-hearted people, and it's not that Doc was the one who worked hard on doing every aspect. That wasn't it. It was that it honored Doc's family's sensibility, which is this kind-hearted, family-centered, wonderful thing. And that's what Merle Fest still represents today, even though you know, they'll draw up to 100,000 people to this festival. And some of the small things as part of Merlefest, you know, the whole community really runs off of Merlefest now. All the nonprofits earn their, a lot of times, their whole yearly budget from just Merlefest because you're not, there are no vendors at Merlefest except for local nonprofits, and all beverages are sold by students of the university itself in order to pay for their own trips. I forget exactly, but it's all done for charity. It's all local. It's a wonderful thing.
That's in our remaining moments here, Kent, and there's so much more we could cover. We could do a two-hour show, but of course, at this point, we can let our listeners know, of course, to purchase the book, and we'll just wrap up with that in a few moments, remind them again where they can do that to hear all the stories. But the Grammys that he won, obviously great recognition. 1973 was his first Grammy. In 2004, he got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys, and I think six all told. What did that represent to him? Did he appreciate getting that recognition?
I think what's interesting about Doc is he doesn't want to be appreciated. And I think it's always a confusing thing with an artist like him. He's had a love-hate relationship with fame. Obviously, in his mind, my opinion is that he believes that fame took Merle away from him, you know, and fame took him away from his family for a long time and a lot of his life. But it also put him on many platforms, and it helped him to change the face of Appalachians in national discourse. It changed so many things in folk music and in bluegrass and jazz. And somebody like Sam Bush wouldn't be here if it weren't for Doc. Somebody like, you know, Tony Rice or Edgar Meyer or Bela Fleck, you know, they all got a platform because of Doc and Merle. So he had a massive, massive impact. His great, great, great grandchildren in terms of music are now on stage. You know, Chris Thiele's new band, what's called Punch Brothers, unbelievably incredible musical talent, but they also have heart. They have the heart of the old music that kind of comes out of Doc Watson. You know, Clarence White sat at the feet of Doc Watson, one of the greatest players ever to play the guitar. You know, Tony Rice saw Doc play in the 60s in California. And his legacy is huge. And the difficulty is that he doesn't want to be appreciated. He doesn't want people to focus on him. He didn't want this biography written. He doesn't, and yet he loves to be on stage. He loves his fans. He loves that he's been able to teach people about love and the gospel and about music and about technique and all these different things. So it's kind of it's a gray area, you know. Yeah. He loves crowds and he loves being on stage, but he just wants to be left alone most of the time. So I think
so
with the Grammys, yeah, he's very honored, you know, absolutely honored. But I think it's every time it's like he has to go with humility and think, gosh, you know, do I have
on
to go there
note,
again?
You know. Yeah, we're just down to our last minute or so. Just remind us where we can buy the book and where we can look for a little more about you out there.
Well, people can come to my website at kentgustafson.com or they can go to docwatsonbook.com and they can find out a bunch of stuff about the book and they can look for the book just about anywhere. Just type in Doc Watson book and you'll find it just about anywhere.
Perfect. Been such a pleasure, Kent. Thank you so much. Learned a lot about Doc Watson and look forward to finding out more about him.
And thank you so much.
My guest today has been Dr. Kent Gustafson, and he is the author of Blind But Now I See. It's the biography of music legend Doc Watson. I'm Dave Woods, and that'll wrap up this edition of In the Country.
Spend some time in the country. We're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country. Leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone. The best in music, too. Spend some time in the country. We've been waiting.